From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
It is perhaps the most anticipated debate of the entire
election. It is hard to imagine anything could even partially eclipse that which has the potential to be the most remarkable debate in political history.
This is an unusual debate, an unprecedented debate for the vice presidential candidates.
This wasn't a political debate. The great showdown between vice presidential candidates Joe Biden and Sarah Palin was an episode of American Idol. Who would be Clay Aiken? Who would be William Hung? Would Joe Biden inexplicably tell a dirty joke? Would Sarah Palin ramble incoherently? And as a sideshow, there was moderator Gwen Ifill, who is writing a book pegged to the Barack Obama candidacy. Would she be, as the McCain camp hinted, a biased arbiter? Yeah, well, none of the above. Here's what happened. Biden was Biden.
To give you a $5,000 plan, which his website points out, will go straight to the insurance company. And then you're going to have to replace a $12,000, that's the average cost of the plan you get through your employer. It costs $12,000. You're going to have to replace a $12,000 plan.
And Palin was Palin, as perky and wholesome as all get out.
Darn right it was the predator lenders.
Joe Sixpack, hockey moms across the nation for 30 years, and God bless her, her reward is in heaven, right? We have an opportunity to learn a heck of a lot of good lessons. Say it ain't so, Joe, there you go again.
So Biden did not come unhinged, and in the wake of the disastrous Katie Couric interviews, those who wished to see Governor Palin act like a nincompoop were disappointed. She committed no major blunder, was conversant on some policy issues, and stayed on message, mainly by ignoring Ifill's questions and launching into her talking points. Ifill, immobilized perhaps by more than the cast on her leg, did not protest. And thus, the New York Times on Friday, in separate analyses, gave Palin her props. She had succeeded by not failing. Why wait for the Times? Cable news was awash in dial groups offering summary judgments. CNN equipped its group with handheld perception meters so we could watch its real-time reactions in squiggles across the screen. Mark Jerkowitz, associate director of the Pew Research Center's Project for Excellence in Journalism, says such gimmicks have made cable news a prime destination for campaign coverage.
Somewhere in the neighborhood of 60% of all the time of cable news is about the election. And in some ways, this is going to be remembered as an election in which sort of cable took over the campaign franchise from broadcast news in a really decisive way. But so many of these cable commentators are, you know, avowed partisans. And even on CNN, where you tend to get anchors who, like Anderson Cooper and Wolf Blitzer, who give no hint of bias, when they roll out their panels, you are dealing with folks who are predetermined to like one candidate or the other.
Well, for example, here is the analysis on Fox from former Senator Fred Thompson.
I've seen quite a few of these things. I've never seen a performance like that. I just thought it did an absolutely masterful job.
So what are we to make of that?
There, at least you get truth in advertising. I mean, at this point in the campaign season, I would assume that many American viewers are sophisticated enough to know that if you're literally getting a Republican surrogate, whether it's Fred Thompson or Rudy Giuliani or a Democratic surrogate, then you know you're getting an avowedly partisan reaction. And frankly, you know, that wrapper already says we've got 52 calories on it, or don't take this with other medications. Caveat emptor on that one. You've been warned.
What's the point of the exercise? Why, you know, why turn into a news channel to see somebody say something that they are predetermined to say?
Well, and that's a very good point. What in many cases now, what's really happened on cable news is, you know, people are doing some level of cafeteria-style news seeking, meaning that, you know, you're going to go and listen to the commentator or the cable network that you think is going to fundamentally agree with you. There's something else we should say, though, about post-debate spin that's important, which is that a key element now of deciding who's won these things or commenting on them are these snap opinion polls that come out now. And you can actually see in many cases it looks like the commentators are sort of tepidly and gingerly waiting for Vox Pop to tell them who won the debate as opposed to necessarily relying on their own instincts.
Now, tell me about some of these snap polls.
The public, I think, when it comes to the issue of sort of who do they think won, sometimes takes different cues than the pundits and the analysts. And I think a good example of that, frankly, was the first debate between Barack Obama and John McCain. The general consensus, if you're going to sum it up roughly, was that it was pretty much a draw. But there were a lot of pundits out there who felt that McCain had sort of won the debate. If you score it like a boxing match, he had been more aggressive. And then the snap polls came out, and almost all of them showed the same thing, which was, you know, Obama seeming to do better in this debate by a fairly comfortable margin, and what the media considered to be sort of overt deference and politeness on Obama's part might have been considered nonpartisanship by voters who are not partisans on either side. It's interesting. I think these sort of instant polls tend, it seems to me, to harden the conventional wisdom about a winner and a loser in a debate much more quickly than we're used to.
And therein the question of media responsibility. It was certainly fascinating to watch CNN and see the squiggly lines, but 20 people in a room is not data. It does not project. So if it's not statistically significant, what's CNN doing putting it underneath the debate in real time? Is that good journalism?
It's another bell and a whistle is what it is, obviously. It's interesting. I mean, the folks who figure out what we might want to see on our screens during a debate may know more about human behavior than we do. I couldn't keep my eyes off those two bars, even though they may not really be telling us anything significant whatsoever. Part of this, no doubt, really belongs more in the category of cable marketing than it does, obviously, in solid informative journalism. No doubt about that.
Mark Jerkowitz is the Associate Director of the Pew Research Center's Project for Excellence in Journalism. Mark, thank you very much, as always.
You're welcome, Bob.
Alaska has a very narrow maritime border between a foreign country, Russia, and on our other side, the land boundary that we
Alaska
have.
Alaska and Russia are only separated by a narrow maritime border. You've got Alaska here, and this right here is water, and then that's up there's Russia.
That was Sarah Palin, followed by Tina Fey doing her celebrated impression of Palin on Saturday Night Live. There's a long tradition in comedy of parodying politicians with their own words, accents, and mannerisms. I remember when I was 7 in 1962 listening to Vaughn Meader's parody of the Kennedys on his album The First Family.
Sir?
Yes?
When will we send a man to the moon?
Whenever Senator Goldwater wants to go.
In the decades since, comedians have lampooned every president from Johnson to Bush too. Jim Morris is still famous for his eerily precise take on Ronald Reagan. Jim, welcome to the show.
Well, hi. How are you?
Good. Let's talk about Vaughn Meader. His album, The First Family, was huge in its day. It won a Grammy for Album of the Year in 1963.
Now, let me say, I don't see why a person of the Jewish faith can't be president of the United States. I know as a Catholic, I could never vote for him, but other than that...
For the Impressionist, for the working Impressionist, it's certainly an inspiration, and it's a starting point, and it's part of my folk history. Of course, it was a physical impression as well.
And then another Impressionist came along, obviously more versatile than Meader. Probably the quintessential impression of Richard Nixon was David Fries. I remember his head sunken into the chest, arms raised in double peace signs. This was very, very broad, and yet it said something about the guy.
You know, it takes a really good Impressionist to crack the code and to figure out how to do someone. And for me, he was the gold standard.
Take a letter. Dear Dick, I think you're doing a magnificent job. Your public appearances are quite exciting. You are what I would call an activist president. I'll read that back and give it some feeling.
David Fry's impression and all the other impressionists that he influenced created a kind of Nixon that became, I think, in time mixed in our minds with the actual Nixon.
Well, in the public's minds, if you can capture the imagination of the listener and get them to suspend their disbelief, then they go with you. And when they think of that person, they're going to hear your rendition of them in their head. Chevy Chase, when he did his Gerald Ford impression, I would assume that people couldn't look at the president without thinking of him bumping his head.
My fellow Americans, my first announcement is one I think you've all been waiting for. Oh, no problem. No. Okay.
Ford was said to be rather athletic. And yet, when Ford died a couple of years ago, many TV news shows played those skits in their commemorations. I mean, it wasn't a great impression, but it was the pop cultural memory we all shared.
That's right. That's right. The impressionist does have the ability to strike a chord in the same way that an editorial cartoonist might, by accentuating big ears or heavy eyebrows or jowls. It becomes part of our association with that person.
What's the goal? Is the goal just to create a memorable character, a funny character? Are you trying to have an influence on the sort of national dialogue on our perceptions of our leaders, or is it basically...
you've been reading my mail. I mean, basically, that's how I describe what I do. When I was a kid, I was supposed to respect authority, and through mockery and getting people to laugh, I was able to cut them down to size a little bit.
So how did you go about crafting your Ronald Reagan?
Well, there was a lot of research involved. Of course, he had quite a life already, well documented. He was a folk figure in America, done a lot of movies, television shows. So for me, it was a matter of immersing myself in this man's life.
When you do an impression of a sitting president, making them laugh is number one, but do you think it serves another purpose?
Well, as an audience member, you feel a moment of superiority over the subject. The playing field is leveled because what you do is you pop that bubble of pomposity that the politician has, and that is very empowering. It's very cathartic. And what I do at the end of my show is I open it up to questions for the president, the sitting president, whoever he may be. The beauty of it is when people forget that I'm just Jim Morris playing a president and they get angry and they say, but Mr. President, you said, and then everybody shares a laugh. I'm able to take people behind closed doors. That's the power of this art form.
Jim, thank you very, very much.
Well, I appreciate it. God bless you. And just remember that even though Hillary did not get the nomination, I am going to work tirelessly for what was his name again?
Impressionist Jim Morris.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, the nation weighed a $700 billion bailout bill, plus another $150 billion in so-called sweeteners, against the fear of the economic unknown. It felt a lot like handing our life savings over to a guy who knows a guy. That's about how much trust we seem to have in the officials we elected to make such decisions, and how much we trust our source for information, the media. We called Andrew Kohut, president of Pew Research Center, for numbers to back up our trust assumptions. He confirmed that only 39% of the public believes the media usually gets the facts right. Meanwhile, the president's approval ratings are down to a paltry 28%, according to Pew, and a lowly 22%, according to a recent CBS survey. Pew found that only 31% trust the government in general. Gallup pegs that trust at 26%, tying with the record low in 1973. The result? Something like paralysis. Andrew Kohut.
What we now face is a problem where that distrust does not enable political leadership to rally the public to the solutions that it proposes.
And it strikes us that it's exacerbated by the ever-dropping approval rating for the media.
Unquestionably, trust in the news media is at a very low point in this time. But it's not only the absolute levels of trust. One of the real differences about the media these days is that people have different views of the media and trust in the media based upon their partisanship. And that makes it very difficult at a time like this for the public to look to to news organizations and say they're giving us the information that we need to make a good judgment. Can I say something? One of the most remarkable things about this reaction to the rescue or bailout plan was the claim by the members of the Congress who voted against it that public opinion was overwhelmingly against this bill. That's just not true. Public opinion is divided about this bill. Even though people are angry and suspicious about it, In our poll, and the CBS poll, and the Washington Post survey, the public is pretty much evenly split about a bill that they have great doubts about because of their concerns. But the squeaky wheels who call their members of Congress because they have intense ideological concerns or other kinds of concerns somehow became a representative of what public opinion was, and it just wasn't the case.
And yet the Congress people, especially those in tight races, responded, which suggests that with the lack of trust in government, we're heading towards a kind of government by email and phone call referendum.
Well, to a certain extent, that's the case on a lot of issues. It's certainly been the case on gun control and other issues where the vocal minority has a bigger sway than the overall majority because it makes so much noise in a politically effective way.
So you found, just to be clear, you found in your polls that a slight majority of Americans favored this bill from the start, not just after the stock market tanked for the second time?
Right. In the third week of September, we found a 55% majority of the public favoring it. This week, we found a 48 to 37% plurality favoring it. Support for the plan had slipped, but the public was still leaning to it. And that is pretty consistent with what other polls this week have shown, that the public is divided, not overwhelmingly opposed to this plan.
Okay. Thanks so much.
Okay, Brooke.
Andrew Kohut is the president of the Pew Research Center. In March of 1933, a recently inaugurated Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressed anxious Americans who were living through that last great economic crisis.
I can never be sufficiently grateful to the people for the loyal support that they have given me in their acceptance of the judgment that has dictated our course, even though all our processes may not have seemed clear to them. After all, there is an element in the readjustment of our financial system more important than currency, more important than gold, and that is the confidence of the people themselves.
This week, both presidential candidates talked about uniting behind a bailout, or if you prefer, rescue plan. Obama even quoted FDR's fireside chat. Of course, we have to be careful about drawing too many parallels between that crisis and this one. As historian and Columbia University Provost Alan Brinkley explains, the past is full of parallels and disparities. For example, when the markets first crashed in 1929, most people were, at least initially, simply captivated by the story.
The stock market crash in October 29 was a focus of tremendous fascination, but not yet a focus of panic because very few people were affected by it immediately. It took time for the economy to start spiraling downwards more generally. This time, people have a stronger sense of how important the markets are, and that's what's creating so much fear. But there's also, as in 1929, a lot of resentment focused on Wall Street.
Can the public's confidence or trust be built by a lame duck president and a Congress and media establishment with dismal approval ratings?
I think we're in a unique period at this moment where virtually every institution seems to be disappointing people. So it's not just the general lack of trust that we're dealing with here. It's this leadership vacuum. There really is just no point at which any major public institution seem to have a lot of confidence. And that's a dangerous moment to be in a financial crisis.
Do you know how the public responded to proposed government reforms during the Depression?
Once Roosevelt became president, the public responded very positively to almost everything he did, at least for a while, because they were so desperate for a leader, and Franklin Roosevelt was a very forceful leader from the very beginning. He had perhaps the most power over Congress that any president has ever had, except perhaps during wartime. For 2 years, he basically owned Congress. He could get virtually anything through Congress.
I'm just wondering, the new president that we'll have will be arriving roughly the same time as Roosevelt
Let's hope that things get better before January 20th. But it is certainly possible that the new president will come into office under conditions very similar to the ones that Roosevelt came in. The day he was inaugurated was a day in which banks were failing all over the United States. And the very first thing he did as president was to call what he called a bank holiday, which was a euphemism for shutting down all the banks until they could make sure they were solvent. I don't think we're going to have bank failures in that way because of the FDIC, which Roosevelt created. But we could have real financial panic in this country at the time of the inauguration if things get much worse.
You know, there's an argument to be made that people want to trust their government in times of crisis to make a decision that might well be unpopular. Now we have a dangerous trust deficit. Do you think that this is the legacy of a White House crying wolf over weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, echoed in large part by Congress and by the mainstream media?
It goes back to the Iraq War, to the Lewinsky scandal, to a whole range of things. But much more damage came from the false arguments, whether knowingly false or not, of the president and others about the Iraq War, Katrina. There's a long litany of points at which trust has been eroded in the last 8 years.
Can you recall another time in American history where there seemed to be so little confidence in our institutions, that is, the White House, the Congress, and the media?
Not in my lifetime. There's been no time in which economic confidence has been as shaken as I think it is today. But I think the late 60s was a time in which there was extraordinarily little confidence in leadership for other reasons, which included economic problems, but that wasn't primarily the problem. The Vietnam War, instability, crime, scandal, that was probably a low point in popular faith in leadership. But we're probably getting close to that point today.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Alan Brinkley is the provost and a professor of history at Columbia University. For reporters, the problem with covering the science of economics is that it's not really a science. There is cause and effect, but very little consensus on what exactly those are in any particular case. This poses a special problem for David Kestenbaum, a physicist who has worked as a reporter for nearly a decade on NPR's science desk. Just last month, he switched to the economics beat and found himself hacking his way through a thicket of conflicting theories and assumptions. David, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much.
Okay, so David, I have a joke for you, all right?
Oh, good.
A physicist, an engineer, and an economist are stranded on an island with nothing to eat. A can of soup washes ashore. Desperate to open it, the physicist examines the physical properties of the can. The engineer looks to improvise a tool to penetrate the can. And the economist says, assume a can opener. Okay, so it's not so funny. Do you think it rings true or not?
Sure. I mean, it's not like physics, right? In physics and science in general, I would argue you are in general moving toward truth. You know, you're moving toward an answer. I mean, no one thinks Einstein was wrong, right? But economics, you know, I just feel like there are very few solid places to stand.
So here you are. You're new. Chaos all around you. I don't know. What do you do?
Basically, my approach is to talk to five times as many people as I normally would, you know, in a beat that I know well. I just overreport all these stories. You know, when someone says something to me, I say it back to them. I say, are you saying this, this, this? Do I have that right? And a lot of the errors in reporting happen this way, right? It's that you think you've understood something and that you haven't. And so I'm trying to be really careful that I actually, what I understand is correct.
But for someone like you, a physicist, a science reporter, tiptoeing your way through a minefield of opinion that's
right,
being presented as fact, how do you sort through them?
The things that I find really confounding are like, you'll be talking to someone and then this little thought will occur to you like, wait, what is money? And like, that's like, you know, you could go for, that could be like 4 days of time right there, but you're on deadline and you gotta put the story together.
They're assuming a can opener.
They're assuming the can opener. I mean, you know, my friend and colleague Adam Davidson here was explaining like GDP to me and about, you know, it's the sum of goods and services. And like, I buy something from you and then they buy something from someone else. And that's good. That all counts toward it. And I said, well, why don't you and I just stand in the corner of the office with $1 million bill? You'll make some piece of junk, that pencil. I'll buy it from you for $1 million, and I'll sell you my sock for $1 million back and forth, and we'll increase the GDP. And then you have to stop and think about why that doesn't actually make sense. But again, these are like, you know, long philosophical inquiries, and I got to do a news story.
But it's an interesting question you raise. I mean, is that what's been going on? People have been exchanging socks and pencils for $1 million a piece?
And the government's now going to buy up all our socks?
Exactly.
And hope that at some point there's a greater demand for socks? Yeah, I think that's exactly what's going on.
Well, thank you for clearing that up, David Kestenbaum.
You're welcome.
David Kestenbaum was one of NPR's science correspondents. Now he's covering the economy for NPR's Planet Money.
Last week, the blog search engine Technorati released its annual State of the Blogosphere. The conclusion? The state of the blogosphere is strong. In fact, almost half of the 133 million blogs that have been created since 2002 were created in the past year and a half. But something else was created in direct proportion: potential liability for libel, copyright infringement, defamation, or invasion of privacy. The Media Bloggers Association tracks the rising number of lawsuits against bloggers, and MBA founder Robert Cox says that even frivolous litigation costs money to defend, and legitimate claims have no limit. The mere threat of a lawsuit, he says, is sometimes enough to scare writers out of the blogosphere altogether.
There was a blogger up in Newburyport, Massachusetts, who wrote a blog called the Newburyport Report. She went in to investigate who was buying up property in her town. She published public records on her website, and shortly thereafter was notified by an attorney representing the real estate developer to cease and desist, or he'd take her into court. By the time she called us, it was actually too late. She had already responded to the threat by not only taking down the posts about the acquisition of real estate in her town, but had shut down her blog entirely. And in talking to her and trying to encourage her to get the site back up, she told me, and this is fairly common, "I didn't get into it for this. You know, this was a fun thing for me. It was reporting about my town. I was engaging my neighbors. And all of a sudden, I'm dealing with the threat of a lawsuit. Thanks, but no thanks."
That's obviously a horror story. Do you have any reason to think that it is being replayed over and over and over?
Yeah, we've been involved in hundreds of cases over the past 4.5 years, ranging from threats and cease and desist letters all the way up to federal lawsuits. The Media Law Resource Center tracks these cases and reports that there's been over $16 million in judgments against bloggers. That doesn't include cases that settled out of court. We're tracking actual cases filed in court. That number has been doubling every year since 2002. Our organization is predicated on the idea that citizen media, citizen journalism, blogging is an important transformative event for our society and has a potential for great good. We want more voices, and it shouldn't matter if somebody's working on it part-time, on a non-professional basis, or full-time as a professional. We want people to have their opportunity to say their piece, and if bloggers don't have an ability to push back in the event of a threatened litigation, we're going to lose voices, and the greater good that can be accomplished is going to be lost.
Tell me about the insurance program. How does it work?
Well, join the Media Bloggers Association. That costs $25, and there's a process for doing that, which includes passing a test on a course we developed. Once they're a member of the association, they would click through over to the insurance company's website. They answer some questions. I think there's 14 of them. And generally, that'll pop out an insurance quote, and then they can go ahead and make a purchase through PayPal.
Some bloggers, maybe many, are simply irresponsible in some of their posts. They're either unaware of basic standards of fairness, or they imagine themselves invulnerable somehow to the consequences of libel and defamation and plagiarism and copyright infringement, what have you. Maybe a few successful lawsuits are just what the doctor ordered.
Well, it's not our view that it's our blogger right or wrong. I mean, we're not interested in defending bloggers who defame people or steal other people's creative works or things like that. I think that the real issue here is that you have people now who are very passionate and excited about participating in an online dialogue through blogs. Our view is, let's take that passion, channel it by giving them education. That's why we came up with a course in media law for bloggers.
Now, the course administered by the Poynter Institute teaches those basics of fairness, journalistic ethics, liability, and so forth.
We reached out to Poynter, which clearly has an interest in educating people in the area of journalism, and we developed a course that covers the basics. It takes about an hour to do. I'm going to go out on a limb here and say it's the most fun and engaging course in media law in the world, because I don't think there are any other fun courses in media law. There's some you make the call type case studies. And when they walk away, they should have a basic understanding of the law. We're not trying to turn these bloggers into lawyers. We just want them to know what the kind of questions are they should be asking. And then that builds on the other things that we've done, which is developing access to attorneys. We have two programs for that, one for the insured. They can get access to one of the leading media defense firms in the country. And for those who don't get the insurance and otherwise couldn't afford a lawyer, we've developed a network around the country of about 40 law firms that have agreed to offer pro bono legal services, consultations, risk assessment, some basic advice of how to respond to a threat.
All right. One last thing, Bob. There's a legal principle known as deep pockets. Lawsuits tend to get filed in direct relationship to defendants' ability to pay an eventual judgment. By insuring bloggers, aren't you deepening their pockets and actually creating a market for litigation that didn't hitherto exist?
Bloggers do have assets already. They have future income streams. They have homes. They have cars. And if they lose a judgment and they don't pay, the sheriff will be knocking at their door, and it won't matter whether they have insurance or not.
Bob, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Robert Cox is founder of the Media Bloggers Association.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, where arts and education leaders can learn about how to bring the arts to more people. Downloads at the Knowledge Center at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Throughout the short life of the new media, we at On the Media have always held one truth to be self-evident. That, of course, being that porn drives the internet. That fundamental belief was shaken a few weeks ago when we spotted a blasphemous headline exclaiming, "Social networking surpasses porn." That assertion comes from Bill Tanser, author of Click, What Millions of People Are Doing Online and Why It Matters. Tanser, who studies all of our online search habits, has the data to back that assertion up.
Our theory is that it's a zero-sum game. We only have so many hours in the day. Social networking now taking up so much time for the younger demographic, they're spending less time on porn sites.
And you had one singular anecdote to sort of underpin all of this.
Yes. So that was one of the most fascinating times is when we looked at the 2 days in summer, it was I think 2 years ago, that MySpace was unavailable. Where did people go when they didn't have access to what at the time was the number one site visited across all internet sites that we track? The thing that we found that happened when MySpace went down was that visits to dating sites and adult entertainment sites were the two categories of sites that increased.
By how much?
About a 10% increase to both, which is pretty substantial in terms of the data that we track.
So let's seamlessly segue into Viagra. You have a lot of data on this from two streams. One is the billions of emails that we get spam about these products, and the other involves searches that seem to spike during the Super Bowl.
If you look at the trending of spam on Viagra, there also is a corresponding increase in searches on Viagra, which might indicate that although it's extremely annoying, it may actually be raising awareness of erectile dysfunction drugs. You also mentioned that Super Bowl is when we see the spike in Viagra searches. We think that's caused by Super Bowl commercials. And, of course, we found that with all of the erectile dysfunction drugs that have been advertised during Super Bowl, they all experience increases during that week.
So you don't relate it to the, you know, testosteronic impact of watching the game?
Yeah, that's, of course, a theory that you could pursue. But looking at the data, I think it's more directly driven from the actual advertisements.
I was really interested by what you found with online gambling. You found an inverse relationship between online sports betting and online poker.
That's right. I noticed this negative correlation between visits to online poker sites versus visits to sportsbook sites. And when I say negative correlation is one goes up, the other goes down. Almost a perfect negative correlation. What it told us about the online gambler in aggregate is that it's probably also a zero-sum game. As sports season starts to die down, they'll take the same amount of money they would have bet in a sports book and then visit poker sites, for example, to place bets. So a certain amount of money to spend on betting at any given time and a trade-off between the two activities.
Bill, have you wondered why there's so much vice that shows up in your data? And in fact, PPC generally stands for pay per click, but you've adopted the acronym to stand for porn, pills, and casinos. If porn isn't driving the net, is vice in general?
I don't know that it actually is driving the net. You know, as we mentioned from the other statistics, there's other categories of sites that are increasing. But the thing I found most interesting about porn, pills, and casinos is that it highlights a deficiency in the traditional ways we conduct market research. If you did a telephone poll, for example, and asked people how much time you spend on adult entertainment sites, probably not going to get an accurate answer. Something that in the research field we call cognitive dissonance. People want to appear in the best light possible. And sometimes they will change their answers from reality to an answer that shows them in a more positive light. Now, if we compare that type of research, traditional surveys, to observed behavior, which is what we're looking at, what people are doing in aggregate on the internet, we see a big difference. What we think about the economy, what we think about politicians, all of that data, what we might not admit to on a survey may show up in our aggregate search behavior.
Now, I get that. On the other hand, not everybody is online yet. In fact, many, many more people have telephones. So why do you think that you get a truer picture of the population in general from just evaluating what the online population does?
And Brooke, that's a very good point that you bring up. There is still a segment of the population who's not online, and this data doesn't apply to them. The flip side of that is looking at how traditional polls are conducted today. I mentioned this in the book. One of the challenges with conducting traditional polls is getting to those households that no longer have a landline phone. Most polls conducted by random digit dial or a machine that's randomly dialing up phone numbers, you can't use those machines when dialing cell phones.
And so we're going to assume that all those guys have computers.
I don't think you can assume that either, but know that there's problems with getting a representative sample on both sides.
Since people use the internet alone, usually, and since people vote alone in the voting booth, do you think that you can predict better how people may behave on that fateful day?
That's one area I can't predict. And those that know me know that I've predicted American Idol results. I've predicted Dancing with the Stars. I'm often asked, can I predict who's going to win in November? And the answer is no, for a very interesting reason. Last presidential election, we saw this phenomenon in our politics category. We were tracking political blogs, and we actually coded them by those that were more liberal, those that are more conservative, and those that are more centric. And the closer we got to election, the more crossover traffic was happening between those blogs. And what we think was happening is that the closer you got to election, people were visiting the opposing viewpoint, not because they supported it, but because they wanted to arm their arguments with what was ever featured on the opponent's site. And so this crossover going back and forth, it confounds the variable, makes it almost impossible to separate out. Is someone popular because they're popular or because somebody wants to find dirt on them or find something to fuel their own arguments?
Now, are you just being cynical, or do you know that when somebody goes from the American Spectator site to a relatively neutral site like Real Clear Politics to the Huffington Post, that they're really just looking to arm themselves against the arguments of their opponents? Isn't there just the remote possibility that they're looking for information that may run counter to their convictions?
It may be a little bit. I think you're right. There also is some swing vote in there that might be people that are truly trying to make a decision and are using the internet as a tool to make that decision. My point is that the variables become confounded and you really can't separate the two, which makes it almost impossible to say who's going to win.
All right. Thanks very much for being on the show.
Thanks, Brooke.
Bill Tanzer's new book is Click, What Millions of People Are Doing Online and Why It Matters.
When word got out a year ago about a new streaming video website from NBC Universal and News Corp called Hulu, the tech blog community erupted in ridicule. Oh yeah, mainstream media is going to take on YouTube and pirated video sites. That should be amusing. Well, months after Hulu's official launch and over 100 million streams later, the skeptics are eating their words. PC World named Hulu the number one product of 2008. Number two was the iPhone. And now lots of those snarky bloggers are watching hit shows on Hulu, along with long-forgotten series, decades-old episodes of Meet the Press, and even shows made just for the web. Jason Kyler is the CEO of Hulu, and he says there's no shortage of video sites offering TV shows. It's just that most of them aren't legal.
You can certainly go after that and legally try and address that problem, but it's a very challenging and daunting task. I prefer to actually go out and compete with those types of services because they're very good services.
One of the interesting things about Hulu is that even though Fox and NBC are its principal backers, I can find other content on there from Viacom, its Comedy Central and CBS and so forth. Now, that was clearly a strategic decision not to exclude the competition. How did you come to that decision?
We're a startup who's focused on the user, and the user, quite frankly, wants it all. They want all the content. That's why, yes, we started with two investors that happen to be content partners, but now we're over 100 content partners, folks like Warner Brothers and Viacom and, you know, sports leagues. It was a very conscious decision to make sure that this was not about just two content partners, but rather everyone.
If people are watching NBC and Fox programs and programming actually from other sources on Hulu, then they are not watching their local TV stations upon which these vast media organizations depend for the, you know, the biggest part of their distribution. You're killing my local TV station, aren't you?
You know, people are spending more time online, and that's with or without Hulu. And increasingly over the last 5 years, a portion of that time is downloading television content illegally. The question is, as an industry, should content owners try and compete with piracy and try and be relevant in an environment that people are spending more and more time, which is the internet, or should they sit on the sidelines?
As to my original question about local affiliates, would you go to the National Association of Broadcasters without a personal security detail at this point?
No, not at all. And, you know, what's interesting is that we make the entire Hulu content library available to every one of their websites. Right now, if you take a look at the Hulu library, it's been embedded on over 41,000 websites. So if I were a local station owner, you know, clearly I'd be thinking about, well, how can I, you know, make sure that my brand is relevant in the online space? And we'd love to help, and we have helped.
Tell me about how my experience with advertising is different on Hulu than it would be, say, with broadcast.
We wanted to do a couple of things with the user experience. One is we wanted to have a reasonable advertising load. The amount of ads that you see on Hulu are about a quarter of what you would see in the living room. But there's also good news for advertisers because you can do a lot more targeting on a service like Hulu than you can in other channels. And I'll give you just one example. If you're a car company and you have a number of cars that you'd like to market, traditionally you make estimates as to what car you want to put against what show. Whereas on Hulu, you can let the user decide. So at a commercial break, the user can decide whether they want to watch a sports car ad, a minivan ad, or a hybrid. And when the user makes the decision, it's a much more efficient match, and you have a much more engaged viewer.
And by the way, in the not-too-distant future, my local pizzeria will be able to detect my IP address and advertise to me on a program it never would have had access to under traditional media circumstances.
That's exactly right. People all across the U.S., for example, have access to content now 24/7, but advertisers should also have access to that service 24/7. And so the notion of a pizza delivery company in Santa Monica, California, being able to get access at just the dinner hour on a Friday night for their specific one-mile radius is something that we absolutely believe is in the future for Hulu.
The question is, though, whether you can enjoy enough volume and a large enough premium for your, you know, enhanced targeting before the networks collapse due to their own shrinking audiences. I mean, can you get there in time?
There's a natural tendency that people have, particularly, you know, bloggers and journalists, to basically say, the world has changed and I'm going to be dramatic, when in reality, any consumer behavior change like this takes a long time. You know, e-commerce is a great example. E-commerce has been written about quite a bit in the press. And if you were to look at the sort of the amount of headlines and coverage about its impact on the world, you would think that 50% of retail is actually occurring online, when in fact the reality is that it's far less than 10%. These, you know, transitions and migrations take much, much longer than anybody thinks. That said, more and more minutes are being spent online, and Hulu is a service that's absolutely seeking to be relevant in that space.
Well, Jason, thank you very much.
Of course, Bob.
Jason Kyler is the CEO of Hulu.
On September 24th, Japan confirmed Taro Aso as its fourth prime minister in 2 years. Aso is known, among other things, for wearing gold chains, smoking Cuban cigars, and for being a huge comic book fan. One report has him reading 10 a week. He argues that Japan can exercise diplomatic soft power through the export of its comic culture, known as manga. Manga makes use of simple lines to create diversions ranging from how-to books to hardcore porn. Here in the States, it's swept everything from the publishing world to Hollywood. Exactly a year ago, University of Tokyo lecturer Roland Keltz shared some manga lore with me. I told him about the day when I was in Barnes & Noble with my daughter, standing in front of a wall of manga. I asked her what it was, and she said, "You wouldn't be interested." And I said, "No, I really want to know." And she said, "It's girls in miniskirts kicking people."
That's great. That's great. So, you know, some of it definitely is girls in miniskirts kicking and punching on their way to world domination. I think one possible analogy would be to compare it to the appeal of punk music upon a certain generation of teenagers, or hip-hop upon a later generation. And manga sales really took off in the U.S. and in Europe in the start of this century, when the importers and publishers overseas started to actually print it the way it reads here in Japan, which is from right to left. When they made that switch, they suddenly acquired a whole new cadre of fans who seemed to approve of the fact that this was not the way their parents read books.
Well, let's get down to a nitty-gritty definition of manga, because now that there is a genre for boys and girls and middle-aged businessmen and older women and for cooking and recipes and how to pay your taxes, how would you define something that ranges across so many audiences and so many topics?
Well, you're quite right that it's a protean art form. Historically speaking, the word can be traced back to the great woodblock print artist of the 19th century. His name was Hokusai. He coined the term to basically mean throwaway pictures. But the form that we know today was developed by a great artist named Osamu Tezuka, who in the 1950s created a hero that some Americans are familiar with now named Astro Boy.
I remember him well.
Yeah, I do. Well, Tezuka was working out of the ashes of World War II in Japan. So his version of manga contained a lot of the trauma and feelings of terror and resentment and vengeance in some way that existed in Japan after having been destroyed, really, by two atomic bombs. And that art form is really what we're talking about when we talk about manga today. And that art form then became almost an underground form of expression in Japan. It could say anything. It could say what you couldn't say in movies or TV.
Why do you think that so many anime characters don't have mouths?
Oh, yeah. When I interviewed the people who created Hello Kitty, I said, "Why no mouth?" And they said, "Because when you look at Hello Kitty, she should feel like you do. If you're in a great mood, she feels great. And your mind will project the emotions onto that face without the mouth telling you how to feel."
You say that it springs from a sort of underground sensibility, but can manga be cool if every salaryman is reading them on the train at night on their way home?
Salarymen and businesswomen are now reading manga in different forms, the most popular of which is the Japanese cell phone. And part of the reason is that if you're reading something that's a little bit unsavory, you can do so with much greater privacy if you're holding a cell phone screen up to your face. So manga is, in a sense, mainstream, but they're not acknowledged purchases.
You mean they're guilty pleasures?
Guilty pleasures, very much so, and private guilty pleasures in a lot of ways.
And yet you said that Aso and others within the government have coined the term manga diplomacy. That's public.
It's very public. And, you know, I just had lunch last week with an official from the government who has been working on this very project. And, you know, he emphasized to me that the importance of selecting the titles they actually choose to promote. So they're very aware of the fact that if manga diplomacy is going to be a popular art form that represents Japan, they don't want the girls kicking in their miniskirts to have miniskirts that are too short.
Roland, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Roland Keltz is the author of Japan America, How Japanese Pop Culture Has Invaded the U.S. We spoke to him in September of 07.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh. We also had help from Michael Bernstein and Andy Lancet. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the School of Visual Arts, hosting an information session for their new program, Master of Fine Arts in Interaction Design, on November 1st at the New York campus. More at interactiondesign.sva.edu. Support for On the Media also comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.